He felt acutely the contrast between his own life and his friend's, and it seemed to him unjust. Gallagher was his inferior in birth and education. He was sure that he could do something better than his friend had ever done, or ever could do. Something higher than mere tawdry journalism. If he only got the chance. What was it that stood in his way? His unfortunate timidity. He wished to vindicate himself in some way, to assert his manhood. He saw behind Gallagher's refusal of his invitation. Gallagher was only patronizing him by his friendliness, just as he was patronizing Ireland by his visit. The barman brought their drinks. Little Chandler pushed one glass towards his friend and took up the other boldly. "Who knows," he said, as they lifted their glasses. "When you come next year, I may have the pleasure of wishing long life and happiness to Mr. and Mrs. Ignatius Gallagher." Ignatius Gallagher, in the act of drinking, closed one eye expressively over the rim of his glass. When he had drunk, he smacked his lips decisively, set down his glass, and said, "No bloomin' fear of that, my boy. I'm going to have my fling first and see a bit of life in the world before I put my head in the sack, if I ever do." "Someday you will," said little Chandler calmly. Ignatius Gallagher turned his orange tie and slate blue eyes full upon his friend. "You think so?" he said. "You'll put your head in the sack," repeated little Chandler stoutly. "Like everyone else, if you can find the girl." He had slightly emphasized his tone, and he was aware that he had betrayed himself. But, though the color had heightened in his cheek, he did not flinch from his friend's gaze. Ignatius Gallagher watched him for a few moments and then said, "If ever it occurs, you may bet your bottom dollar there'll be no mooning and spooning about it. I mean to marry money. She'll have a good fat account at the bank or she won't do for me." Little Chandler shook his head. "Why, man alive," said Ignatius Gallagher vehemently, "do you know what it is? I've only to say the word, and tomorrow I can have the woman and the cash. You don't believe it? Well, I know it. There are hundreds, what am I saying? Thousands of rich Germans and Jews, rotten with money, that'd be only too glad. You wait a while, my boy. See if I don't play my cards properly. When I go about a thing, I mean business, I tell you. You just wait." He tossed his glass to his mouth, finished his drink, and laughed loudly. Then he looked thoughtfully before him and said in a calmer tone, "But I'm in no hurry. They can wait. I don't fancy tying myself up to one woman, you know." He imitated with his mouth the act of tasting and made a wry face. "Must get a bit stale, I should think," he said. Little Chandler sat in the room off the hall, holding a child in his arms. To save money, they kept no servant, but Annie's young sister Monica came for an hour or so in the morning and an hour or so in the evening to help. But Monica had gone home long ago. It was 9:15. Little Chandler had come home late for tea, and moreover, he had forgotten to bring Annie home the parcel of coffee from Bewley's. Of course, she was in a bad humor and gave him short answers. She said she would do without any tea, but when it came near the time at which the shop at the corner closed, she decided to go out herself for 1/4 pound of tea and 2 pounds of sugar. She put the sleeping child deftly in his arms and said, "Here, don't waken him." A little lamp with a white china shade stood upon the table, and its light fell over a photograph, which was enclosed in a frame of crumpled horn. It was Annie's photograph. Little Chandler looked at it, pausing at the thin, tight lips. She wore the pale blue summer blouse which he had brought her home as a present one Saturday. It had cost him 10 and 11 pence. But what an agony of nervousness it had cost him. How he had suffered that day, waiting at the shop door until the shop was empty, standing at the counter and trying to appear at his ease while the girl piled ladies' blouses before him, paying at the desk and forgetting to take up the odd penny of his change, being called back by the cashier and, finally, striving to hide his blushes as he left the shop by examining the parcel to see if it was securely tied. When he brought the blouse home, Annie kissed him and said it was very pretty and stylish. But when she heard the price, she threw the blouse on the table and said it was a regular swindle to charge 10 and 11 pence for that. At first, she wanted to take it back, but when she tried it on, she was delighted with it. especially with the make of the sleeves, and kissed him and said he was very good to think of her. He looked coldly into the eyes of the photograph, and they answered coldly. Certainly they were pretty, and the face itself was pretty. But he found something mean in it. Why was it so unconscious and ladylike? The composure of the eyes irritated him. They repelled him and defied him. There was no passion in them, no rapture. He thought of what Gallagher had said about rich Jewesses. Those dark oriental eyes, he thought. How full they are of passion, of voluptuous longing. Why had he married the eyes in the photograph? He caught himself up at the question and glanced nervously around the room. He found something mean in the pretty furniture which he had bought for his house on the hire system. Annie had chosen it herself, and it reminded him of her. It, too, was prim and pretty. A dull resentment against his life awoke within him. Could he not escape from his little house? Was it too late for him to try to live bravely like Gallagher? Could he go to London? There was the furniture still to be paid for. If he could only write a book and get it published, that might open the way for him. A volume of Byron's poems lay before him on the table. He opened it cautiously with his left hand, lest he should waken the child, and began to read the first poem in the book. Hushed are the winds, and still the evening gloom. Not e'en a zephyr wanders through the grove, whilst I return to view my Margaret's tomb, and scatter flowers on the dust I love. He paused. He felt the rhythm of the verse about him in the room. How melancholy it was. Could he too write like that? Express the melancholy of his soul in verse? There were so many things he wanted to describe. His sensation of a few hours before on Grattan Bridge, for example. If he could get back again into that mood. The child awoke and began to cry. He turned from the page and tried to hush it, but it would not be hushed. He began to rock it to and fro in his arms, but its wailing cry grew keener. He rocked it faster while his eyes began to read the second stanza. Within this narrow cell reclines her clay. That clay where once... It was useless. He couldn't read. He couldn't do anything. The wailing of the child pierced the drum of his ear. It was useless. Useless! He was a prisoner for life. His arms trembled with anger, and suddenly bending to the child's face, he shouted, "Stop!" The child stopped for an instant, had a spasm of fright, and began to scream. He jumped up from his chair and walked hastily up and down the room with the child in his arms. It began to sob piteously, losing its breath for 4 or 5 seconds and then bursting out anew. The thin walls of the room echoed the sound. He tried to soothe it, but it sobbed more convulsively. He looked at the contracted and quivering face of the child and began to be alarmed. He counted 7 sobs without a break between them and caught the child to his breast in fright. If it died! The door was burst open and a young woman ran in, panting. "What is it? What is it?" she cried. The child, hearing its mother's voice, broke out into a paroxysm of sobbing. "It's nothing, Annie, it's nothing." He began to cry. She flung her parcels on the floor and snatched the child from him. "What have you done to him?" she cried, glaring into his face. Little Chandler sustained for one moment the gaze of her eyes, and his heart closed together as he met the hatred in them. He began to stammer. "It's nothing." He began to cry. "I couldn't... I didn't do anything." "What?" Giving no heed to him, she began to walk up and down the room, clasping the child tightly in her arms and murmuring, "My little man, my little Manny, was you frightened, love? There now, love, there now. Lamb of bone, mamma's little lamb of the world. There now." Little Chandler felt his cheeks suffused with shame, and he stood back out of the lamplight. He listened, while the paroxysm of the child's sobbing grew less and less, and tears of remorse started to his eyes.